Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis. In April 1956, C.S. Lewis, a confirmed bachelor, married Joy Davidman, an American poet with two small children. After four brief, intensely happy years, Lewis found himself alone again and inconsolable. To defend himself against the loss of God, Lewis wrote this journal, an eloquent statement of rediscovered faith. In it, he freely confesses his doubts, his rage, and his awareness of human frailty. In it, he finds again the way back to life. C.S. Lewis was one of the intellectual giants of the 20th century, and arguably the most influential Christian writer of his day. Chapter 1. No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear. I am not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the restlessness, the yawning, I keep on swallowing. At other times, it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There is a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says. Or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It is so uninteresting. Yet I want the others to be about me. I dread the moments when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not to me. There are moments most unexpectedly when something inside me tries to assure me that I don't really mind so much, not so very much after all. Love is not the whole of a man's life. I was happy before I met H. I've plenty of what are called resources. People get over these things. Come, I shan't do so badly. One is ashamed to listen to this voice, but it seems for a little to be making out a good case. Then comes a sudden jab of red-hot memory, and all this common sense vanishes like an ant in the mouth of a furnace. On the rebound, one passes into tears and pathos, maudlin tears. I almost prefer the moments of agony. These, at least, are clean and honest. But the bath of self-pity, the wallow, the loathsome, stick-sweet pleasure of indulging it, that disgusts me. And even while I'm doing it, I know it leads me to misrepresent hate yourself. Give that mood its head, and in a few minutes I shall have substituted for the real woman a mere doll to be blubbered over. Thank God the memory of her is still so strong. Will it always be too strong to let me get away with it? For H wasn't like that at all. Her mind was lithe and quick and muscular as a leopard. Passion, tenderness, and pain were all equally unable to disarm it. It scented the first whiff of cant or slush, then sprang and knocked you over before you knew what was happening. How many bubbles of mine she pricked. I soon learned not to talk to her unless I did it, for the sheer pleasure. And there's another red-hot jab of being exposed and laughed at. I was never less silly than his hateous lover. And no one ever told me about the laziness of grief, except at my job, where the machine seems to run on much as usual. I loathe the slightest effort. Not only writing, but even reading a letter is too much, even shaving. What does it matter now whether my cheek is rough or smooth? They say an unhappy man wants distractions, something to take him out of himself. Only as a dog-tired man wants an extra blanket on a cold night, he'd rather lie there shivering than get up and find one. It's easy to see why the lonely become untidy, finally dirty and disgusting. Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms, when you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption. If you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcome with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is in vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are no lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seemed so once. And that seeming was as strong as this. What can this mean? Why is he so present a commander in our time of prosperity, and so very absent a help in time of trouble? I tried to put some of these thoughts to sea this afternoon. He reminded me that the same thing seems to have happened to Christ. Why hast thou forsaken me? I know, does that make it easier to understand? Not that I am, I think, in much danger of ceasing to believe in God. The real danger is of coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion I dread is not, so there's no God after all, but, so this is what God's really like. Deceive yourself no longer. Our elder submitted and said, thy will be done. How often had bitter resentment been stifled through sheer terror and an act of love. Yes, in every sense an act, put on to hide the operation. Of course, it's easy to say that God seems absent at our greatest need, because he is absent, non-existent. But then, why does he seem so present when, to put it quite frankly, we don't ask for him? One thing, however, marriage has done for me. I can never again believe that religion is manufactured out of our unconscious, starved desires and is a substitute for sex. For those few years, H and I feasted on love, every mode of it, solemn and merry, romantic and realistic, sometimes as dramatic as a thunderstorm, sometimes as comfortable and unemphatic as putting on your soft slippers. No cranny of heart or body remained unsatisfied. If God were a substitute for love, we ought to have lost all interest in him. Who'd bother about substitutes when he has the thing itself? But that isn't what happens. We both knew we wanted something beside one another. Quite a different kind of something, a quite different kind of want. You might as well say that when lovers have one another, they will never want to read or eat or breathe. After the death of a friend years ago, I had for some time a most vivid feeling of certainty about his continued life, even his enchanted life. I have begged to be given even 100th part of the same assurance about H. There is no answer. Only the locked door, the iron curtain, the vacuum, absolute zero. Them as asks don't get. I was a fool to ask. For now, even if that assurance came, I should distrust it. I should think it a self-hypnosis included by my own prayers. At any rate, I must keep clear of the spiritualists. I promised H I would. She knew something of those circles. Keeping promises to the dead or to anyone else is very well, but I begin to see that respect for the wishes of the dead is a trap. Yesterday I stopped myself only in time from saying about some trifle H would have liked that. This is unfair to the others. I should soon be using what H would have liked as an instrument of domestic tyranny, with her supposed likings becoming a thinner and thinner disguise for my own. I cannot talk to the children about her. The moment I try, there appears in their faces neither grief nor love, nor fear nor pity, but the most fatal of all non-conductors, embarrassment. They look as if I were committing an indecency. They are longing for me to stop. I felt just the same after my own mother's death, when my father mentioned her. I can't blame them, it's the way boys are. I sometimes think that shame, mere awkward, senseless shame, does as much towards preventing good acts and straightforward happiness as any of our own vices can do. And not only in boyhood. Or are the boys right? What would H herself think of this terrible little notebook to which I come back and back? Are these jottings morbid? I once read the sentence, I lay awake all night with toothache, thinking about toothache and about lying awake. That's true to life. Part of every misery is, so to speak, the misery's shadow of reflection. The fact that you don't merrily suffer, but have to keep on thinking about the fact that you suffer. I not only live each endless day in grief, but live each day thinking about living each day in grief. Do these notes merely aggravate that side of it? Merely confirm the monotonous treadmill march of the mind round one subject? But what am I to do? I must have some drug, and reading isn't a strong enough drug now. By writing it all down, all, no one thought in 100. I believe I get a little outside it. That's how I defend it to H. But 10-1, she'd see a hole in the defense. It isn't only the boys either. An odd byproduct of my loss is that I'm aware of being an embarrassment to everyone I meet, at work, at the club, in the street. I see people as they approach me, trying to make up their minds whether they'll say something about it or not. I hate it if they do, and if they don't. Some funk it altogether. R has been avoiding me for a week. I like best the well-brought-up young men, almost boys, who walk up to me as if I were a dentist, turn very red, get it over, and then edge away to the bar as quickly as they decently can. Perhaps the bereaved ought to be isolated in special settlements like lepers. To some, I am worse than an embarrassment. I am a death's head. Whenever I meet a happily married pair, I can feel them both thinking, one or other of us, some day, will be as he is now. At first I was very afraid of going to places where H and I had been happy. Our favourite pub, our favourite wood. But I decided to do it at once, like sending a pilot up again as soon as possible after he's had a crash. Unexpectedly, it makes no difference. Her absence is no more emphatic in those places than anywhere else. It's not local at all. I suppose that if one were forbidden all salt, one wouldn't notice it much more in any one food than another. Eating in general would be different every day at every meal. It is like that. The act of living is different all through. Her absence is like the sky spread over everything. But no, that's not quite accurate. There is one place where her absence comes locally home to me, and it is a place I can't avoid. I mean my own body. It had such a different importance while it was the body of H's lover. Now it's like an empty house. But don't let me deceive myself. This body would become important to me again, and pretty quickly, if I thought there was anything wrong with it. Cancer and cancer and cancer. My mother, my father, my wife. I wonder who is next in the queue. Yet H herself, dying of it, and well knowing the fact, said that she had lost a great deal of her old horror at it. When the reality came, the name and the idea were in some degree disarmed, and up to a point, I very nearly understood. This is important. One never meets just cancer, or war, or unhappiness, or happiness. One only meets each hour, or moment that comes. All manner of ups and downs, many bad spots in our best times, many good ones in our worst. One never gets the total impact of what we call the thing itself, but we call it wrongly. The thing itself is simply all those ups and downs. The rest is a name or an idea. It is incredible how much happiness, even how much gaiety we sometimes had together after all hope was gone. How long, how tranquilly, how nourishingly we talked together that last night. And yet, not quite together. There's a limit to the one flesh. You can't really share someone else's weakness or fear or pain. What you feel may be bad. It might conceivably be as bad as what the other felt, though I should distrust anyone who claimed that it was. But it would still be quite different. When I speak of fear, I mean the merely animal fear, the recoil of the organism from its destruction, the smothery feeling, the sense of being a rat in a trap. It can't be transferred. The mind can sympathize, the body less. In one way, the bodies of lovers can do at least. All their love passages have trained them to have not identical, but complementary, correlative, even opposite feelings about one another. We both knew this. I had my miseries, not hers. She had hers, not mine. The end of hers would be the coming of age of mine. We were both setting out on different roads. This cold truth, this terrible traffic regulation, you, madame, to the right, you, sir, to the left, is just the beginning of the separation which is death itself. And the separation, I suppose, waits for all. I have been thinking of H and myself as peculiarly unfortunate, as being torn apart. But presumably all lovers are. She once said to me, even if we both died at exactly the same moment as we lie here side by side, it would be just as much a separation as the one you're so afraid of. Of course, she didn't know any more than I do, but she was near death, near enough to make a good shot. She used to go out alone into the alone. She said it felt like that. And how immensely improbable that it should be otherwise. Time and space and body were the very things that brought us together, the telephone wires by which we communicated. Cut one off, or cut both off simultaneously, either way, mustn't the conversation stop. Unless you assume that some other means of communication, utterly different, yet doing the same work, will be immediately substituted. But then, what conceivable point could there be in serving the old ones? Is God a clown who whips away your bowl of soup one moment in order, next moment, to replace it with another bowl of the same soup? Even nature isn't such a clown as that. She never plays exactly the same tune twice. It is hard to have patience with people who say there is no death or death doesn't matter. There is death, and whatever is matters, and whatever happens has consequences, and it and they are irrevocable and irreversible. You might as well say that birth doesn't matter. I look up at the night sky. Is anything more certain than that in all these vast times and spaces? If I were allowed to search them, I should nowhere find her face, her voice, her touch. She died. She is dead. Is the word so difficult to learn? I have no photograph of her that's any good. I cannot even see her face distinctly in my imagination. Yet the odd face of some stranger seen in the crowd this morning may come before me in vivid perfection the moment I close my eyes tonight. No doubt the explanation is simple enough. We have seen the faces of those we know best so variously, from so many angles, in so many lights, with so many expressions, waking, sleeping, laughing, crying, eating, talking, thinking, that all the impressions crowd into our memory together and cancel out in a mere blur. But her voice is still vivid. The remembered voice that can turn me at any moment into a whimpering child.